In cities and states across the country, austerity budgets are bad news for teachers. California sent layoff notices to 19,000 teachers. Detroit plans to close half of its public schools or convert them to charters. Wisconsin stripped collective bargaining rights from its teachers. Education expert Diane Ravitch says what's happening to public schools in America is not about the money. Ravitch herself is part of the story. She was Assistant Secretary of Education under George Bush Sr. She was a strong proponent of charter schools and the No Child Left Behind program. But in a new book called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, Ravitch says she's changed her mind. She told Steve Paulson there's a political agenda behind all the recent school cuts.
This is not just states responding to the need for austerity. The larger picture and the context which I've been trying to provide both in my book and in my lectures has been we have a very powerful corporate reform movement. They talk about reform. What their real goals are is, first of all, privatization, taking public money out of the public sector and having deregulated schools with very little public oversight. So it's privatization, but it's also deprofessionalization. They want to be able to hire teachers who have very little training, and also to hire principals who were never educators and to hire superintendents who were never educators, and to relax the rules across the board. The thing that's so wrong about all of this is, first of all, there is absolutely no research to support any of these changes, that they don't improve things for kids. And secondly, if you look at the highest performing nations in the world, none of them are doing this. They are strengthening and improving their public education sector.
What would be an example of that, of another country,
sure.
a success story where there's a different model?
The great success story is Finland. And Finland really changed its education system over the past 30 years to recruit and attract the best teachers. Finland is first in the world on the international assessment called PISA, Program and International Student Assessment. And on the PISA, Finland is first in the world. It's 100% union, and it never gives any standardized tests at all until kids apply to college. 40% of the kids in its high schools are in training for career programs, but they all take the same tests that our kids do. And it has a very low rate of poverty. I mean, this is the big, big difference between the U.S. and Finland, and that is that less than 3% of their children are in poverty, and more than 20% of our children are in poverty. The great narrative in this country that's coming from people like, whether it's the right wing of the Republican Party or President Obama and the Gates Foundation, it's all the same narrative, and that is that poverty doesn't matter. And yet we have decades and decades of social science that says that poverty is the single most powerful predictor of low academic achievement. And so when you have a city like Detroit or Baltimore or any number of others that I could mention that have very low rates of academic achievement, it correlates with very, very high rates of not only poverty, but racial isolation.
Let's talk more about charter schools, because this is being held up now as the great alternative to our decades of public schools. First of all, tell us a little bit about how charter schools are set up. I mean, for the most part, these are within the public school structure, but they have private management, right?
Uh-huh. Charter schools have become the replacement for vouchers, and whenever vouchers have been put to a vote, they have been turned down. So charters have become the stand-in because they are privately managed, they get public money, they are not subject to the same rules and regulations as public schools. In most states, they're not even subject to regulations having to do with nepotism and conflict of interest.
So you're saying there are no standards in terms of who can teach in a charter school?
No, none. They can hire anybody. And about 98% of charter schools are non-union. They can hire and fire at will. They can give merit pay or performance pay or whatever they want to call it. And they don't get better results than regular public schools. The media likes to focus on the one charter school where 100% of the kids went on to college. But what they never bothered to look at is how many kids started. And so I've seen story after story of a charter school held up as a miracle school where 150 kids started, but only, let's say, 100 of them graduated. In some cases, it's even smaller than that, are charter schools where they're getting great test scores, but they hold back the kids from the testing who are not going to get great test scores, where they just play with the stats.
So, how can they hold back certain kids so
they don't take the tests? They're not required to promote everybody. So the kids who can't get the great scores are held back and not put into the year where the test will be given. This has happened in place after place. The biggest way in which they are able to game the system is by taking smaller proportions of students who are English language learners, and this has happened in many places, are not taking the kids with profound disabilities.
So you're saying charter schools can reject certain students in a way that the public schools cannot?
They have ways to do that. The lottery is a way of screening out, for instance, homeless families who never find out that there is a lottery. Then there are other kinds of mechanisms that they use to counsel students out. I've been contacted by principals and others who said, every November 1st, I get a wave of the lowest performing kids from the local charter school because they don't want them to drag down their scores. So they send them to my school, dragging down my scores. So this is what competition has created, is everyone's competing to get rid of the low performing kids. This is not good education. This is just the free market distorting what education is supposed to be, which is to attend to the needs of every child and make sure that every child gets a full, balanced education. We're now into a kind of national test score mania that's really corrupting education.
Now, it's also worth pointing out that President Obama is a big fan of charter schools.
Right. President Obama, and I can't explain why this is so, has completely adopted the Republican agenda. The Republican agenda in education for the last 30 years, at least since Ronald Reagan, has been testing, accountability, and choice. Particularly, President Reagan supported vouchers, but then it morphed into this idea of charters taking the place of vouchers. President Obama has sent out Secretary Duncan to campaign with Newt Gingrich in the fall of 2009. President Obama just the other day was in Miami with ex-Governor Jeb Bush, who is reviled by teachers because of his support for vouchers, for charters, for testing, for judging teachers by test scores. He has taken a very strong privatization line, and President Obama was in Miami to salute him as an education reformer and to celebrate test scores at a high school in Miami.
Now, I have to ask you about your own perspective on all of these things, because you were once a huge advocate of No Child Left Behind. You were a big advocate of charter schools, and it's worth pointing out your track record is not exactly as a flaming liberal on education issues. You were the Assistant Secretary of Education under the first President Bush. Later, you received funding from various conservative groups, the John M. Olin Foundation, the Hoover Institution. What happened?
Well, I changed my mind over time. Like, for instance, in 2004, I publicly wrote an op-ed piece with Randy Weingarten saying that mayoral control in New York City was leaving the public out of public education. So that was a beginning. There were other moments where I was in meetings with governors and CEOs who were complaining about those overpaid teachers. And I looked around the table and thought, there's not a person in this room who could live on a teacher's salary. That changed my mind. But the moment that I concluded that NCLB was a failure was
No Child Left Behind.
No Child Left Behind. When I concluded that the federal law itself was a failure was when I was invited to a meeting, a day-long meeting at a conservative think tank, the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. And my job was to sum up the papers that day. The conference was about, how's No Child Left Behind doing? What progress have we made in the first half decade? And there were a dozen papers, and each of the papers said, it's not working. Choice is not working. The required tutoring is not working. We're not seeing any real improvement in test scores. And there were papers from across the country. There were papers from rural areas. There were papers from big cities. There were papers from the East, the West, the North, the South. And at the end of the day, I had to sum this up, and I had to say, it's not working. And from that moment on, I really found my own views about No Child Left Behind dramatically altered.
Now, you've talked about what you see as wrong with a lot of educational policy now, especially the efforts to reform schools. What should we be thinking about? I mean, what makes the best schools?
Well, the first thing that makes the best schools is having a community of deeply involved families and parents, and having children who are well-fed, who don't have medical problems, having children arrive in school ready to learn, and having a balanced curriculum that includes all the things that we know matter, not just basic skills of reading, writing, and math, but also history and geography and civics and the arts, having a great arts program, physical education, a health program. All of those things are important in a good school. But within the context of a community where there are immense social problems, the government has to address the social problems. We can't assume that schools alone can solve the problems of poverty. We lead the world now, at least amongst the advanced nations, in the number of children living in poverty. And that hurts educational achievement. There are people, and I've heard Secretary Duncan say this, I've heard various educational leaders, most of them non-educators, say poverty doesn't matter. Poverty does matter. When children are hungry, when children are sick, when children are homeless, when they live in a community where crime and violence and incarceration and unemployment and decay, when these things are commonplace, it affects their motivation, it affects their attitude, it affects even their willingness to come to school every day. So what most educators have long understood is there is an interconnection between school and society. John Dewey wrote about this. Other wise people have written about this. Schools don't stand alone. They're part of a community. They should be the element that uplifts the community, that civilizes the community, that brings a sense of what the better things in life are, that gives children a sense of possibility, of ambition, of breaking the limits. But they can't do that in isolation. They do it only when working in tandem with a government that is humane, compassionate, and concerned about the well-being of its citizens.
Diane Ravitch was Assistant Secretary of Education under George Bush Sr. She's written more than 20 books about education, most recently, The Death and Life of the Great American School System.